Thank you. My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. Thank you. I'm glad to welcome the people that are new here. Got to be a weird feeling, doesn't it, to wind up on a Saturday night in church? We know you weren't planning on this 90 days ago if you're new here. You had dreams and plans. And I really do welcome you here. I really am glad that you're here, and I'm glad that you came up. And for anybody that's sitting here that couldn't get up here tonight as a new guy or a new woman, I really especially welcome you. You'll get another opportunity to come up here. And for those of you that came up and saw people take cakes for a few years, saw people celebrate 8 or 10 or 16 years of sobriety, it must seem like they have some great capacity to quit drinking. And if that's your feeling, and you have discovered already that you can't quit, if you know, because you've tried, that you can't quit, welcome home. Welcome home. We are a bunch of people that cannot quit. And we're not drinking anymore. And it's important to notice that a real alcoholic, if you're a real alcoholic, like I'm a real alcoholic, you will not quit. Can't be done. There are people that come to AA and then they leave and they do just fine. But I don't think they're real alcoholics. You know, they're not here tonight, and I think because they quit. there's some people that can quit. But the ones in this room are not quitters. Not one of us can quit. They're just not part of the deal here to quit. And that's worth noticing, because the last drink I ever had was on the 14th of August, 1966. So I've spent, and I'm 63 now, I spent 34 years in AA, more than half my life. And I didn't quit. I had no idea on that day that I came to AA that I wouldn't be drinking anymore. I had tried many times before that to quit. I quit, one time it seemed to me that it was getting almost as bad as my wife thought it was getting, and I'm going to quit. I was on active duty at Camp Pendleton, and I went to the chaplain and told him I'm quitting. He thought that was a good idea. I went to my commander. He thought it was a good idea. I told him. I went to the base psychiatrist that I'd been seeing. It turned out he was a dermatologist, but I went to him anyway. Told him I'm quitting. I went to the minister in town, and I quit. I'm quitting. And 6 weeks later, I'm drunker than I have ever been. At sick bay, they gave me some pills that would calm me down so I wouldn't need to drink. Those don't work for me, pills. I don't get any chemical peace of mind. There's no way that I can do that. And there's no way that I can quit. And so 6 weeks later, I'm drunk again. And I didn't get it. And a few weeks later, I'm quitting. And it lasted 2 days. And then I go a long time. And then I get decided, and she left. And on and on. And I'm in trouble in the Marine Corps. And I've got this problem and that problem. And I, every once in a while, and I wound up when I was, some years went by. I went to jail a lot, slept in the park a lot, but sometimes I get back to my little room. I had a little room. I had a room in a building that where four of us had little rooms. I called it a double garage for many years, and some time ago now, my wife and I were over in Glendale, California, and she said, down by L.A., and she said, I want to see that garage. And we drove down in there, and she said, is that it? Is that the building? I said, yeah. She said, that's not a garage. That's a shed is what that is. And I looked, and by God, no car had ever gotten in that place. And it was just a little shed, and four of us lived there. Four of us lived in that little shed. We each had a little room. My room was very smelly and nasty, and it had a sticky linoleum floor, and I had nothing left, except I had a radio, one of those clock radios that I remember it because it played music at weird hours of the day and night. It'd just start to play. It'd keep on playing even after you turn it off, you know, it just plays. You unplug it and it plays. That thing plays. Take it out and set it in the dirt, it plays. Couldn't turn it off. And I had a little box of underwear and a couple of sheets in there. I don't know why I still had that, but I had that. And that was it. That was my life. I went to jail, or I slept in the park, or I went to the room, and I had long ago given up any idea of a normal life. I had long prior to that given up any idea that I could be married or raise children. I knew that, and I didn't want to see them. I didn't want my wives, there had been two wives and three sons, and I didn't want to be seen by any of them. And I had some strange illusions that there were people coming after me. Strange ideas. Waking up in jail. There's kind of a funny thing. When you wake up in that state, you really need a drink. And then you realize, if you realize that you're in jail, once you get that, you don't need a drink quite as bad. You know what I mean? You know you're not going to get one, and it's sort of like take some off of it somehow. And they empty the fella in a tank, and then they line guys like me up and the rest of the guys in the tank, and we go down and stand in front of the judge, and he calls the cases, and we say things like, guilty, guilty. Or somebody will say, guilty with an explanation. And you listen then, because if the judge is going for that explanation, it's going to be my explanation too. And it was like that. There was a strange thing. And I had one morning walking out in front of, in that area where I lived, where that shed was, a car pulled up to the curb, and a guy called my name, and I looked, walked over. He said, how you doing? And it was a bail bondsman that had bailed me out of jail a lot of times. I said, I'm not doing so good. He said, I'm going to take you someplace today. And he put me in his car, and he drove me across Glendale, and we went up a long flight of stairs, and we went into a little room, not this size, smaller, middle of the day, in July of that year. And there I am sitting in a meeting, an AA meeting. I had not planned to be there that morning when I came to. I was at two meetings that day before I got back to the room. And for the first time in a long time, I didn't feel like there was some big answer for me here. I didn't feel like this was like I'm home and all of that stuff. I knew from listening to you that you guys were bad drinkers. And you had found something, and I knew I would never find anything for that problem. I just knew that it would not be possible for me to find anything. But the idea is maybe I can hang on and stay sober for 6 weeks like I did that one time. Maybe I can just kind of hang on. There weren't any dreams like get a job, go buy the Lincoln and come go pay the child support and be a big hitter. I didn't have anything like that. There wasn't any illusion left so much. It's just, and 2 weeks went by, and I liked the meetings, and I liked the people that were there. Nice enough people. And I felt safe in those meetings in a way that I didn't feel safe in the room. I didn't feel safe, and I had you know, the room is not safe because not only does that radio play, but I came to one morning underneath that cot. That wet mattress was up over here, and I'm on the floor on that sticky linoleum floor, and there, over in the corner was a rat, a big guy, and he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and he terrified me because I wanted to get up on the bed, and I was afraid to move because I knew that if I spooked him, he'd rush me. And and we both knew he'd win. You know, it was like I had no strength and no power and no... But I never had any. I knew when I was 4 years old that I'm not big enough for this life. I've known that forever, ever. And I'm watching that rat, and then I hunker down and hang on, and I watch him again, and I... And it seemed like hours went by before there was enough light in the room to look over again and see that rat. The first light of day was up, and I looked over again, and in some weird way, that rat turned into a pair of socks laying over there in the corner. And it's why I welcome. If you're new, I'll tell you this. If you're new, and if you've got one of those radios, welcome home. Welcome. If you're new and you've been held hostage by a pair of socks all night, I'm your guy, you know. This is the deal. This is the deal. That's many years ago for me now, but I remember it very, very clearly. And I can remember sitting in those meetings and listening to people talk, and I liked the way you treated one another. I like the feeling like a bunch of guys come in and women coming up here, 40 people, celebrating a miracle. People that have been around a long time, long enough to have come to know the quiet miracle of a sober life, and they're up here excited about it. And you go, wow, that must be different for them. And it is. It's different for me, because I thought I would never get out of that mess. And that guy brought me to you. And then I had a little bit of bad luck. I ran across some change and some amphetamines on the same day. And that 2 weeks of sobriety went up in smoke, and I was bad, bad drunk for three more. And I came to in the room on the 14th of August that year. And I was terrified and very sick and broke, and there's no booze, there's nothing. But somehow in the middle of the morning, I walk over to the club in Glendale. I knew where it was. I walked over there and went up that long flight of metal stairs that's hung on the side of that building on Central Avenue. Glendale Alano Club, whatever that may mean. And I went in, and the door was open, and there was a guy inside doing his job in AA. The coffee was made, and the door was open, and he said hello to me and asked me, how you doing? I got drunk again. Let everybody down. Oh, he said, are you alcoholic? I don't know. But I didn't say that, and I didn't want to lie about it, and I really didn't know. I didn't know. And so I said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now, is what I told him. And what I really would have said, if I could have, was, I'm a mild case. I won't be any trouble. You know, I just want to rest. I just want to take my pack off and be here. But he said something fantastic to me. He said, are you alcoholic, really? I said, yeah, yeah. Now I'm saying it. That changes it a little bit. I couldn't have said it earlier. And he said, well, you say you're alcoholic and you got drunk? I said, yeah. He said, oh, yeah. Alcoholics do that. Right on track, you know. That's what you'll do. In fact, he said this to me, and maybe it's true for you. I know it was true for me when he said it. He said, if you're alcoholic, you're going to drink, and you're going to drink no matter what. You'll drink no matter what. People in AA, he told me, will say, don't drink no matter what. He said, you'll drink no matter what. You're going to drink. He didn't say it unkindly, but he let me have the simple dignity of the fact of the matter. I drink no matter what. I drink. I will say, I'm going to be home right after work. I drink. I'll stop by and pick up the kid. No, I drink. I'll bring the check. No, there's no check. I drink. And the check's gone. I'll tell my commander in the Marine Corps. I'll be there at O'Dark 3. No, I'm not there. I come limping in a little later. And in trouble all the time. I drink no matter what. And when he told me that, I got it. I couldn't have said it, but I got it. Every cell in my body went, yeah, yeah, you drink no matter what. He could have said a lot of things. He could have said, well, you ought to quit. But he's a member of AA, so he knows I'm not going to quit. He knows that. He could have said, well, you should eat more. No, he's in AA. He knows. Could have said, you should cut down. No, he knows. No, he knows. I can't quit. And I never did quit. And this is the interesting thing if you're new. If we could quit, we would have done that. You didn't want to be like that. Come to AA, that's not cool. You don't want to be. No. But we have no place else to go. And in our desperation and in our madness and in our idea that there's nothing to, it's all over, we come here. And somehow or other, if everybody that came up here and took a cake tonight or celebrated a birthday for a year or more tonight would have been able to say what they wanted to say, I doubt any of them would have said, I quit. I just made up my mind and I quit. No, no, that's not it. We can't quit. And the program, this doesn't ask us to quit. If it were Jim came up here and read the 12 steps, you know, they're not shy here in AA. They will tell you. And I think they would have told us right up front, don't you? If they'd have been about quitting, they would have said, step one, quit. Something. Give me a little clue. And it doesn't say that. It says, step one, you got to get that you are toast. Powerless, unmanageable. It's all over. It's all over. There was a guy down in Southern California who used to talk. His name was Chuck. And I like Chuck talking because he'd say, he had many years of sobriety, and he'd talk about his last drunk and his last drink. And he said, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. Gotta like a guy like that, boy, I'll tell you. I mean, it was as much a surprise to him as to anybody. And the fact that I didn't have a drink on the 15th of August is amazing to me, because I had a lot on the 14th. And I did not decide to quit. I could not have decided that. And you have had your last drink, if you're new, without any swearing off. And if you go back out there, you'll come back again and you'll have a day when a miracle happens. And it always comes out of a lot of just lost and no place to go, because that's the state of it and that's the condition we're in. And it's different for different people. When we finally utter that prayer and implore God that we don't really even believe in. It goes like this. I was sober over a year, and I'm sitting in a meeting one night, and L.A., and there was a woman at the podium who was a very compelling woman, that had the beauty of sober women in Alcoholics Anonymous. She was pretty, and she was maybe 30, and she had been sober for a few years. And she's up at the podium, and I'm thinking she's attractive, and maybe we ought to go out to dinner, you know, and all of that. And I remember her talk because she spoke of the alcoholic's prayer that night. Gail was up at the podium looking like a million bucks and telling a story about the alcoholic's prayer, her prayer. She's up there and she's talking about coming out of a blackout on the mantel over the fireplace in her apartment with her cat. The cat's up there. And there's a little cat food and a little vodka up there, a little something for everybody. And I'm liking her more all the time because she looks like a million bucks and she is just a disaster, you know, to hear her drinking story. And the reason that she's up there is because there's 4 inches of water on the floor. Now I'm getting interested. This is a pig, you know. I love these kind of... She wouldn't be critical of me. No, this girl and I could get together. You know what I'm saying? And then she said the reason there was 4 inches of water on the floor was because she'd started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal got away from her somehow. Yes! Yes, Gail, yes! Oh, God Almighty, we must have dinner tonight. Because she's my kind of girl. She gets it. And then she said, sitting there on the mantel over the fireplace with the cat and the vodka and the cat food and all that mess on the floor and the rest of it, she said a prayer. And her prayer, an alcoholic's prayer, Jesus Christ, what's wrong with me? That prayer. Profane, yeah. Angry, yeah. Despairing, heartbreakingly sad. A prayer. What's wrong with me? What is it? I don't want to be like this. And I can't stop. And she made me know as I crawled around on the floor in that little shed, in that sticky linoleum floor, as I heard there was a shower out someplace. I didn't visit it personally, but I heard those guys out there. There were actually men in that little shed that lived there in their rooms that had the strength to go out and take a shower. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I'd hear them throw up in there, and I thought, what men these must be to be able to stand up in a shower and throw up. How nice. And so I welcome you. I really am glad you're here. They welcomed me. They were very kind to me. I went up to a guy when I was 5 days sober and said, how do you get to sleep at night if you don't drink? And he said, you really want to get to sleep? I said, yeah. I was sorry. The minute he said that, I was sorry I asked him. Because they always know this stuff, you know. He said, where do you live? I said, down the street. I didn't tell him about the shed. I just said, I live down the street. He said, are you living alone? I said, yeah. He said, I'll tell you what. When you get back to your home tonight, after the meeting, you want to get to sleep, right? Well, yes. He said, make your bed. Okay. Put clean sheets on your bed. Oh, God, how do you know about those sheets? The psychiatrist never mentioned the sheets. And here's a guy in AA that knows about the sheets. And then he said, after you get that bed made, get in it, say a prayer. He even told me the prayer. If God be for us, who can be against us? And that's St. Paul. I was raised in a very religious home. I don't like St. Paul, never did. But I didn't like the other prayers either. Remember, now I lay me down to sleep. You get to that part, if I should die before I wake, that'll keep you awake a while. Just and I got home to my little room that night of 5 days or 6 days of sobriety under my belt, knowing I would not stay, knowing I cannot stay with these nice people, knowing that I don't know when they find out about me. I will not be welcome here. But this guy had taken a minute with me that night after the meeting. And he knew about the sheets. And so I found a sheet in that box and I put it on the bed. And I don't know, I don't think I knelt down or did anything fancy, but I said that prayer that he told me to say. I knew it wouldn't work. And the next thing I knew, it was 7 o'clock the next morning, and I had slept all night long, and I hadn't slept like that in a year. And I just was doing what the guy told me to do because he knew stuff. It's like when I'm a member of the Pacific Group, and and Clancy's been my sponsor for many, many years. And I was with my son. My wife and I were with my son and his wife and their kids in Washington, D.C. at Easter time. We spent Easter week with them. And it was a very sweet time. And this kid, I just love this boy of mine and his wife and his three. And seven of us sat around a table in the dining room in the Mayflower Hotel and had Easter brunch. And there was nothing on the table between us. There was nothing we couldn't talk about. And that was just by God's grace, because I had more trouble paying child support when he was a baby. After I got sober and I got a job and I'm playing cute with it. And I went up one day to my sponsor and said, you know, I'm going to give you the inside thing on this sponsorship deal. Watch them like a hawk. Just watch them, because they know stuff. And so it's safest, as long as you can put up with this, you just kind of throw them a bone once in a while. You know what I mean? Ask them a question, but make sure you don't care how the answer goes. Should I wear the blue socks or the green socks today? Hey, good, I'll do it. Thanks a lot, you saved my life again with that shit. So one day we're in the backyard. We used to play in the backyard, play ball and stuff in Clancy, and they still do, and it's a wonderful thing. And I really, it was just a remarkable thing to be able to do with those guys, those men and women. But I went up to him one day when this was all kind of early, and I said, Clancy, I got a problem. And he said, what is it? I said, I hate my ex-wife. What's he going to do, right? And he said, do you want to change how you feel about her? Well, now this has taken an ugly turn. Because I really like hating her, you know. I had my driver's license back. It gives you something to do on the freeway. But you don't say that. You say, sure, I do. I wouldn't have bothered you otherwise. He said, good. If you know, I'll tell you, if you want to change how you feel about somebody, change how you treat them. Okay, thanks. He said, come here. How's that child support coming? Oh, I'm going to get to that. He said, yeah, you are. You're either going to do that or you're going to get another sponsor. And he gave me chapter and verse, and he was not amused that I was playing cute with that. Somehow I felt like if I paid it on time, she won, you know? Very weird, yeah. But that's what I... And he, no, you're not going to do that. He said, you're going to... I was doing money orders. I didn't have a checking account until I was 5 years sober. Because I don't do well with a checking account. I'd learned that in AA. So I had money order. You get another money order. Take the envelope down to the bank with you. Have postage and the address on it. And put it in the mail slot before you leave the bank. Do not wait. And within 90 days of doing that, I felt better. And then Christmas, and I felt more human than I had felt in a long time, more like a man than I had ever felt. And then the days and the months and the weeks and the years go by, and at 16 years old, I'm still paying, when he's 16, I'm paying child support. And he graduates from high school and gets into college, and he's out off the payroll, earning his way and doing a wonderful job. And he and I get to sit at a table in the Mayflower Hotel and last Easter in Washington, D.C., and be very, very connected, because there's nothing on the table with a napkin over it that we can't talk about. There's such freedom here. It's just exactly the life that I always wanted, and I could never, ever, ever have found it for myself. I had to be painstakingly taken through this. I squalled when you told me that step two is about coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Because I got this little thing. I'm not insane. Oh, maybe when I was drinking, but not now. And a guy that cared about me said, why don't you write down, just for drill, write down the 20 craziest things you ever did. And let's look at that. And so I come back to him with my list, and I got a list, and you've got a list. But I told him about, first time I went to jail, I was at the University of Oregon. And I had been drinking at an off-campus tavern. A lot of students there, very pretty girl in there. And I found out she was a member of the Tri-Delt House. And she almost looked at me, and so I felt we had an evening together, you know, connected. And then I looked around, and she left, and I'm getting drunker, but I found out where she lived, and I went over there. I drove over there, drove a car over there, and I am going up the fire escape ladder to go discuss our future at midnight, and that's where they arrested me, and... So I wrote that down and I told him about it. I told him about the trouble when I was at dental school. I shake awful bad on Saturday morning, and there's always somebody in a chair in the clinic, and I'm supposed to be doing some work in their mouth, and I'm dropping stuff on the floor, and I drop a few amphetamines. That gives you a fine tremor, and they just come out with that new high-speed air-driven handpiece, and you can wipe out a quadrant of teeth just twitching, and oh, they threw me out of there. I wrote that down for him. I told him about drinking on Skid Row in Portland and coming out of a blackout in one of those toilets and across the table from a woman that I never remember meeting. But I had the feeling we were together, you know what I mean? And she had her things with her in paper bags. I didn't know her name, how long we'd been together, the nature of our relationship. I didn't know... And she was sleeping, or I would have asked her. She had a little chili on her cheek, so I knew we'd had dinner together. Some delicate flower I'd invited to dine, you know. I wrote that down. There's a line in one of the personal stories in the back of the book. It says, somehow I got out of there. This guy, it's sort of the story of my drink, and somehow I got out of there. And in the Marine Corps, when that guy, that commander, said he was going to run a board of inquiry on me, when that guy, that commander said, you know, there's no room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic lieutenant, broke my heart. And I'd go out in the Orange Groves north of the base and drink hot vodka out of a bottle in the car. Crazy. Crazy. And the last drunk driving arrest, there's a whole list. I'll tell you that there was one more thing that I got arrested for drunk driving while I still had a car. The cars disappear. If you notice that, they just go one day, they're gone. But I still had a car, and I'd stop for a light, a red light, and it turned green and amber and red and green. And I was resting, and Guy right behind me is in a squad car, and pretty soon he's rapping at the window and gets me out of the car and has me touching my nose and doing all that. And finally, they always said it, and he was no exception. I'm arresting you for drunk driving. And I want a jury trial, of course. I always wanted a jury trial. But the thing that was interesting and the thing that went on my little list of crazy stuff is that the police report that I saw a few weeks later said, the cop about me said, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. And you go, wow. And so I take my list back to this guy that wants the list of the things I've done, the craziest. And he looks it over. He said, there's a lot of alcohol in this. I said, yeah. Not everything was, but most of it. He said, but you didn't write down the craziest thing you ever did. I said, what are you talking about? He said, and you did it repeatedly. And you did it before you started to drink. Every time you did it before you started to drink. I said, what are you talking about? He said, with all this evidence in here that you should never drink again, and before you started to drink each time, you decided to take another drink. That's crazy. That's crazy. And he said, and you brought that mind into AA. Now, can we go on to step three? I mean, I got to get in touch with the fact that this is not going to work even after I'm sober. I got to drop the idea that I did, that I quit. I didn't quit. I remember reading in that book, they've got a book here called The Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Interesting, fascinating book. And there's a guy named Bill Wilson that wrote that book. And he's one of the co-founders of AA. And he puts stuff in there that just kind of makes you wonder. The goose hung high, Bill? What the hell is that? He said this, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And I'm thinking, how nice for you, Bill. We're all so thrilled. But then one day, you know, you begin to wake up a little bit, and I realized his impact on me was sudden and profound. Sudden and profound. Because on the 14th of August, 1966, I was a drunk. And on the 15th of August, 1966, I was not a drunk. And have not been since then. And that's sudden, isn't it? I mean, we are moving right along. He didn't mull it over. He said, you got it, Slim. You done with this part of your life? I'll take the obsession away. And he did that. And I know he did that because I haven't had a drink since then. And I've been crazy enough to drink. I've been angry enough to drink. I've embarrassed myself enough to drink. I've been humiliated enough to drink. In 34 years, are you kidding? I've been heartbroken. And I didn't drink, and I drink. I drink no matter what, and I didn't drink, and that's a miracle. And the only thing I had to do to begin to notice the miracle was to stop taking credit for it. That's how I missed my miracles. I took credit. And so Wilson said his impact on me was sudden, and God's impact on me was sudden. And it was profound because it went right to that little piece of me that always needs a drink. And healed it. Healed it. There's a piece in me that needs a drink. There's a piece in me that is called to AA. There's a piece in me that is never going to get it. And I have to have some compassion for that little piece in me that's never going to get it. And I can begin to live the quiet miracle of a sober life that way. I was laughing today seeing the Discovery Bay group come up, and Tom and Barbara and the people that I've known and loved over the years, Don and Esther, and to see Jim again and to have Billy pick me up at the airport. Some years ago, I surrendered to a little thing that I had to do. When I was married, before I got to AA, I was married twice. There were three sons. And on each occasion, I left the marriage when the kids were about 4 or 5 years old. Because I'm afraid. I was 4 years old when the violence and the anger and the beatings and the rest of it started in our home. And in being with those kids as their father, I was drinking, but I also had a lot of rage. And I was afraid of what I might do. But this is a generous universe. And I had an opportunity along the way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Linda and I got married 4 years ago, but back, I had an opportunity. I was with a lady and she had a little boy. It's like the universe hands you an envelope and you open it up and then it is a lady and a little boy, a four-year-old boy. And you hand it back to, no, lose the kid. I like the lady, lose the kid. I don't want the kid. I don't want the kid. And the universe comes back and says, no, here's your envelope. Are you going to take it or not? It's a package. You get this envelope or no envelope. If you can't do now what you could have done when you were drinking or what you could not have done when you were drinking, that's fine. But you're given an opportunity. And along the way, a generous universe gave me opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. And this opportunity came along, and I was under new management by that time. So I said, yes, I will accept that. And for 4 years, or five, I had this little boy in my life. I don't know if I can be a good parent. I don't know if that's going to work at all. But it was there in my life to do. I didn't seek it out. It was just part of the package. And we moved and we lived together. And I had the most extraordinary experience. One day, this guy, Daniel, and I are just kind of rapping and laughing and carrying on. And I realized something quite strange. This guy loves me. He loves me. And he didn't have anything on it. It was as clean and sweet a thing as you could ever imagine. And I knew in that instant, because I'd been around you long enough, I knew that what was really happening was that God was loving me through that boy. Just as God loved me through you when I was new and didn't know He loved me. And He was loving me through that boy. And it was a clean and sweet thing, and it wasn't long after that that I realized how much I loved that boy. And I knew that God was loving him through me. And then we had fun. I'd kneel down with him at bedtime and we'd say our prayers. And God, it's wonderful to hear a young kid pray. They say things like, thank you that I was born at the top of the food chain. You know, and you just bust up laughing your butt off. And one day, Don called and told me to get up to Northern California. And I said, I'll be up there. And then as it grew closer, I said, Don, I got to tell you, I'm traveling with a six-year-old because his mother's out of town. He said, bring him on. And we flew up to Oakland like I did today, me and Daniel. And we got in the rental car and we're driving up north, and he and I are talking about something, I don't know what it was, but suddenly I said, you know, Daniel, I love you, man. I really love you, and I love traveling with you. You're a great traveler. He said, thank you. I said, no, I really mean it. You know, when that kid came across from the other side of the plane and he wanted you to go on back and play with him, I'm glad you didn't do that. And he said, well, I didn't really know him that well. And I said, yeah, and I kind of think he wanted to go in the back of the plane and get into trouble. And Daniel looked at me and he said, we don't know that about him. I went, shut up, kid. You've been talking to your mother too much. She goes for that tolerance stuff. Oh, I learned from him and laughed with him. And they're out of my life now. And they're on and doing their thing. And Linda and I have been married, but I remember how much that boy, and I know tonight that the task is very simple. It isn't that we have to love one another, it's that we have to live our lives in such a way that God can love the others through us. It's the sweet peace of anonymity that there is. I wondered for a long time, why is it such a powerful spiritual principle, this anonymity? It's because God's grace comes through me. It's not my signature on it. I just with a guy and he's take him to some meetings and you guys love him and I love him and we're like one day he's got 60 days. Did I do that? Oh no. Did you? No, no. No, but we're living our lives in such a way as sober members of AA that God can love him through us and a miracle takes place. It's like Linda and I have a lot of fun, but my love for her is conditional. When I'm trying, you know, like what dress does she have to wear for my ego to calm down? That. And that's the tip of that iceberg. But sweet things happen. A sweet thing happens when I live my life in such a way that God can love her through me. Because I know He loves me through her. And so if you're new here, there is power here. Power that you've never experienced, no doubt. Power that's been operative in this program for 65 years. And it's called love. And so come on in. We love you. And you'll notice it one of these days. And the damnedest thing will happen to you if you stick around here. Some guy, some woman newer than you will come and sit beside you and you'll find yourself loving that person. And your own healing will begin. And we call that Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks.